It started simply enough, a midweek presser at the Capitol. It was routine. I mean, there's no breaking news in a congressional investigation. There was no significant piece of new legislation to announce. This day, like so many others, was just another day when the filibuster had obstructed passage of a bill proposed and supported by nearly every representative of the majority party. On this day, it was the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that lay in ruins at the feet of Senate Republicans.
Oh, I mean, it's the kind of democracy dismantling move whose commonality makes it barely newsworthy these days.
Then, Latino Rebels Capitol Hill reporter Pablo Manriquez stepped to the mic and posed a question to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
What's your message for voters of color who are concerned that without the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act, they're not going to be able to vote in the midterm?
Well, the concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans.
Yeah, let's hear that one again.
African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans.
Now what's happened next has been epic. Americans took to social media using the hashtag MitchPlease to declare their outrage about Senator McConnell's discursive racial faux pas, which seemed to nullify black citizenship by eliminating the racial modifier for white Americans. When McConnell compared African Americans to Americans, I mean, it's not like he was performing a complex expression of Du Boisian double consciousness. And to many, it felt more like a Freudian revelation that the most powerful Republican lawmaker in the country considers black Americans to be distinct from real Americans. Now, the heavily populated MitchPlease hashtag isn't quite as pervasive as that time that Kim Kardashian West broke the internet with her paper magazine spread in 2014. But just like Kardashian, Senator McConnell did show his backside, and y'all are not having it. Here's what you told us.
He's probably just embodied more of the Trump sense of the sense of stage presence, where you just say the part that you were thinking out loud and then later on just go back and say, oh, that's not what I meant. But that's exactly what he meant. It's a racist comment. He's a racist man.
I think this is just another example of how the U.S. sees anyone that is not white. I think he's representative of what is happening everywhere. It doesn't matter how hard you try to get your citizenship here or how you have been living here for several generations. If you're not white, then you're not American.
Nothing surprising about what Mitch said. His mouth said what his heart believes. He just didn't expect it to come out.
We thought you were still locked in the 19th century, but with your recent comment, now it's clear.
Since when are African Americans not Americans? The guy needs to put his white hood back on and go to a rally. I'm sorry. This is too much. The country is too polarized.
Phew. Okay, takeaway. Just go ahead and take a breath. Now, let me be honest. I'm a little less worked up than many. Maybe it's because I've spent a decade being ritually and digitally dragged by ideological opponents operating in bad faith. Maybe it's because Senator McConnell was born in 1942 in Sheffield, Alabama, a town essentially founded by Andrew Jackson. So I'm pleased that a 79-year-old white man from Sheffield, that McConnell, well, he can say African-American without a sneer or a stumble. What does interest me deeply? What makes me lean in with curiosity, compassion, and concern is the response. I'm utterly captivated by the African-American office holders, veterans, teachers, parents, community leaders, media professionals, those anonymous and famous, young and elderly from every region of the country, posting photos, telling their intergenerational stories of citizenship, presence, participation, sacrifice. To me, it feels like watching an entire community producing our long-form birth certificates in mass. It's like Denzel Washington in The Great Debaters. MitchPlease ends up resounding like a unified recitation of Langston Hughes.
I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh. And I eat well, and I grow strong. Tomorrow I will sit at the table when company comes, Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am American.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and we begin today's takeaway with the question, who, too, is American? I'm joined by Pablo Manriquez, Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. It's great to have you here, Pablo.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It's always an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. And also with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who is the Ford Foundation Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School and co-host of the podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are. Welcome back, Khalil.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Pablo, I'm going to come to you. So how is it feeling to help break the internet?
Oh my gosh, it's such a testament to the power of journalism, because I think for like 99.9% of the people who have heard the Mitch McConnell clip, my voice asking the question is just sort of like a disembodied voice. So there's something very humbling to that. Like, my mother recognized my voice when she saw it on Colbert, which was awesome. But overall, it's very humbling to know that, like, you know, a question from a disembodied voice is me and nobody knows it. But everybody knows the response and everybody's reacting to the response one way or another. I think that your assessment of the way it's blown up on the internet is very apt. I absolutely love the poem by Langston Hughes. And I think that that is a question that needed to be asked more and more, not just of Mitch McConnell, but of other lawmakers. For example, the day before I asked Mitch McConnell the question, I asked Joe Manchin the question, who is another person obstructing the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act from within the Democratic Party. I asked him, you know, what do you say to voters of color who are afraid they're not going to be able to vote in the midterm if the John L. Lewis voting rights doesn't pass? And he said, well, the government will protect them. The government will make sure that they are able to vote. When I would ask about voters of color, pretty much every lawmaker who I asked, and these were senators, every senator who I asked said, well, African-Americans are X, you know, X, Y, and Z, they're safe, right? Mm-hmm. So it was like voters of color all automatically become, in the minds of these senators, African-Americans. Like, they have sort of like a knee-jerk reaction to the question. And I think that that's notable.
I want to play one quick thing, because McConnell spoke on Friday. And he said he was clarifying what he said. Let's take a listen.
I want to take an opportunity out there here to address the outrageous mischaracterization of my history and record on voting rights and race relations as a result of inadvertently leaving out the word almost in my comments the other day.
Pablo, where does the almost go?
That's a really good question, because as I understood it, as I read it, he meant almost Americans. So African Americans are voting in just as high a percentage as almost Americans, because after he gave that comment, and he tripled down on that comment after he initially said it, because the reporters, hat tipped to the reporters in Kentucky and in Louisville, Kentucky, who are asking him that question at the Kentuckian Transportation Expo, they said, you know, are you sure you meant to say almost? He's like, the word that was omitted was almost. And then he exited the stage and the camera pans to him. And I assume somebody who is an advisor to McConnell was, you know, a woman kind of walked up to him and showed him her cell phone. And on his cell phone, you could sort of audibly hear her saying, you said almost instead of all, right? And he turned around and he says, the word that was omitted was all. So I assume what he's saying is African-Americans are voting in just as high a percentage as all Americans is what he meant to say. But in my opinion, it just made it worse. McConnell is not somebody who often misspeaks, too, which I think is like really worth saying. He speaks slowly. He speaks deliberately. And most of the time when you catch him in the hallway, he doesn't even acknowledge your presence. He will walk right through your question.
Now, Khalil, what's going on with McConnell is one thing. What's going on with the response is a bit of something else. And I am fascinated by the extent to which, you know, in a nation right now that is deeply polarized, where a lot of hurtful, painful, kind of jaw-dropping things are said on a regular basis, this one really caught fire. I'm wondering what it tells you about that sense of perhaps disconnectedness, or maybe it actually is a sense of connectedness with the nation. Why did voters of color, why do Black and Latino voters right now feel such a need to respond to this?
Well, I think when you have perhaps the most powerful politician in Washington, and I'm not speaking of Joe Biden, but in fact, Mitch McConnell, and the juxtaposition, this sort of racialized or racist juxtaposition, hits home essentially right at the moment of Dr. King's annual holiday. And so you've got the convergence of this powerful opponent of racial progress in this country. You've got the annual rituals of celebration of Dr. King, who's been completely whitewashed and sanitized, and whose legacy has been completely inverted 180 degrees by Mitch McConnell's himself and his party. And then finally, you have the most recent news of yet the failed efforts to protect voting rights in this country. And so I think people just emotionally responded as well they should have.
Khalil, I'm wondering what it also suggests, again, whether for McConnell or in this broader response, about the sort of unspoken racialization of the American identity at all points. This idea of the replacement theory, which we know is a critical part of how many in the January 6th riots were feeling, you know, you shall not replace us. And then this kind of battle right now about teaching a racialized history in K through 12 and even college classrooms. I'm wondering about, like, can we get to a point where American is not only Jefferson, but Jefferson's children who were born by an enslaved woman?
Yes, potentially, but we will only get there if people have the right to vote and can actually build the country in that image, meaning that how we socialize children in our schools depends on a curriculum that is honest and truthful and representative of all the threads of the United States history, including Indigenous people from the very beginning. It depends on our ability to create an infrastructure that supports life for everyone in ways that are not extractive as they were built from the very beginning. I mean, you know, the great irony of this moment is, you know, it reveals yet again for anyone who maybe just turned 18 last weekend is like, oh, now I'm politically conscious, what our country has been. If we want a different country, unfortunately, the pathway to get there is going to pass through what happens at our polls. And so the Republican Party knows exactly what it's doing. It was once the Democratic Party, you know, many years ago. But for a long time, at least a third to half of this country has been opposed to a real functioning democracy and the potential for what we need to redress since 2013, when John Roberts said something very similar to what Mitch McConnell said, is we don't need the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act because the Southern states don't look as Southern and racist as they used to. And so Black voters are voting. So why do we need this anyway? I mean, the echoes are just astounding and recurring.
Pablo, I want to come back to you on this sticking point around non-white voters or non-white Americans equals African Americans. And maybe we could talk a little bit here about the limits of like a citizenship identity as the requirement for Americanness. What are or a particular like Black-white trajectory in our understanding about what America is composed of? Can you talk to me a little bit about that other aspect of the question that you asked about voters of color, and he went directly to Black folk?
Yeah, I think that one of the things you'll find about Republicans generally in the Senate and in the House is that I think about the term African-American as something that's sort of antiquated. I'm not Black, but I've come to most of my friends who have been involved in this discussion have preferred the term Black. I used voters of color because it's hard to name off every group that would be disenfranchised if the John L. Lewis a Voting Rights Act didn't pass, and it didn't pass, right? And the concerns I find that people are telling me about whether or not they're going to be able to vote in the midterm are super legit, in some states more than others. So for Republicans to say again and again, often quoting Dr. King, that Black people don't know what they're talking about, right, when it comes to their vote, was highly offensive to me. But it's also telling of a Congress. And when I say Congress, I don't just mean the elected officials. I mean the entire building, the entire Capitol complex that is entirely too white. You know, like the overwhelming majority of people of color who you will see in the Capitol complex on a daily basis, right, are police, they're service workers. On occasion, you'll find some staffers, but that is sort of changing. For example, this year, they had Representative Zoe Lofgren, who's sort of Nancy Pelosi's right-hand woman in the House of Representatives, approved the passage approved the formation of a Congressional Progressive Staff Association. And this was kind of a big deal. Over 500 people signed up right away. Now you have on Instagram, for example, you have accounts like Dear White Staffers, which is one of the best tipster accounts anywhere on Instagram. If you're trying to work on Capitol Hill, if you're trying to understand just how toxically white the environment can be for staffers who aren't white in the Capitol. So Dear White Staffers and other account, Tired Press Secretary, these are some of the other accounts that have popped up that were kind of unthinkable just a few years ago. So I think that one of the things that the comment kind of points out is just how insular that bubble is. And within that insular bubble, just how white the environment is when you're working as a representative or as a staffer in the Capitol complex, where these votes, where these decisions are made about that that will help or hurt the ability of people throughout the nation to vote and exercise their rights as Americans.
That's a fascinating perspective, and one that obviously most of us don't have, not being insiders within that building or within that the culture of what's happening in that space. There was something else about what he said, and Khalil, I want to come to you on this because I do think that back end part of it keeps us from talking about the front end part, where he makes an assessment, the center makes an assessment about voting, and he's sort of right and wrong, right? Like my inner political science has jumped up screaming and saying, no, I want to address the empirical claim here, because in fact, in 2008 and then in 2012, African-American voting actually exceeded turnout, and particularly for Black women, exceeded turnout for that of white folks. But then in 2016 and 2020, you saw sort of white American voting resurging during these two opportunities to vote for President Trump. And in 2020, everybody turned out at some of the highest rates that we have seen in American history. So it occurs to me that voter suppression efforts might also suppress some white voters. Like, this is generally bad for democracy.
Yeah, but democracy has been bad for minority interests in this country for a long time. So that is all too
familiar. Are you saying we feel okay about sometimes just making a mess of the whole democratic system, Khalil?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think that's what I'm saying. I mean, listen, We have to point out the absurdity of what's going on here. So the justification for blocking the protection of votes in federal elections, mind you, is that everyone's voting. But in fact, at the state level, that everyone voting generated at least 20 bills passed in, at least 30 bills passed in something like 20 states. And so he's not even working with reality. If everything was great and we should keep things the same, things aren't the same because they've actually changed at the state level. So part of this is just keeping up with the lies that come from a party that is not interested in a functioning, healthy democracy, as January 6th attests to, and their unwillingness to come to terms with or accept a fully functioning investigative process.
Pablo, I have to ask you this question. Do you have a list of other questions that you would like to see your colleagues on the Hill or my colleagues and me asking of elected leaders across the coming year? Because, boy, that was a good question.
Well, I think that, and this is something that I've talked about with some of the other reporters on Capitol Hill and at the White House, I think that one of the things that we have to start doing is just leading with the phrase, what's your message for voters of color about? Right. And then the topic that you're covering, because I think that too often we don't center the people who are most impacted by legislation, in this case, like the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act. Right. So what is Joe Biden's message of color
gets hard.
I know. No, but the question that I have this week for Joe Biden at the White House, because Congress is in recess, is, what is his message for immigrants about the unilateral authority that he is willing to exercise as president of the United States to find some forms of immigrant relief that were promised on the campaign trail? There were 167 questions asked last week at Joe Biden's like 2-hour press conference in the East Room of the White House, and none of the questions were about immigration, not a single one. And the sad thing is that when immigration does come up as a topic, and this is a topic that Latino Rebels covers every single day, right? We are day in and day out on the immigration beat. The sad thing is that when you actually do hear the word immigration or immigrants at a White House press conference, it's always in some attempt to have like a gotcha moment about the border, right? Like, how bad do you think you're doing at the border, sir? But that's not what the topic was during the campaign trail when he promised immigrants communities that if he won, he was going to help them out. So far, immigrant communities have not been helped out in the way that he promised. So we've done the diligence on the Hill in the last year. We have asked pretty much every senator in the Democratic caucus now in the Senate about what they're going to do for immigration. And so far, they've just given us the runaround, right? At this point, we've probably gotten 75% of the entire United States Senate on the record about immigration, and every superstar you can imagine in the House of Representatives. And again, they give us all these answers like, yeah, we support this, we support that, but they don't actually do anything. So I think that one of the things that the White House staff, because we're not members of the White House Press Association, so we're not actually allowed, or sorry, the White House Court, we're, sorry, we are not members. Latino Rebels is not members of the White House Correspondents Association. So we are not allowed to go sit in the White House briefing rooms in a chair and ask questions. We're only allowed to take the aisle, but because they have COVID restrictions in place now, they're saying that we can't go. But it's like, hold on a second. You say we can't be a member of your organization and we can't stand in the aisle, which is allocated to people like us who aren't members of your organization. That's not going to fly. So I think that you're going to have a little bit of conflict between us and the White House Correspondents Association this week if they don't find a way to include us in these press conferences, because our question is important and we're going to ask it.
The gauntlet has been laid down, folks, by Pablo Manriquez, Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. Time to ask the question repeatedly, what about immigration reform, Mr. President, given that you do have some unilateral authority as President of the United States? With us also was Khalil Gibran Muhammad, Ford Foundation Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and co-host of the podcast Some of My Best Friends Are. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
They don't believe that anyone who is not a white Republican is a real American. And they believe that all of these registered, valid votes were how the election was stolen, because they don't believe that people who are not white Americans should be able to register and vote. And they believe that the country is being stolen by people who don't look like them.
These are the same Republican lines that they've been saying for years. They used to say back in 1964, black people don't have problems voting. They just have to count all these jelly beans. They just have to tell me how many bubbles are in this bar of soap, or read this piece of the Constitution.
Truthfully, it's an embarrassment to be from the same state as Mitch McConnell. It's truly, truly awful. And it's just another sad mark against Kentucky, I suppose. I don't know. It makes me really sad. I can't believe he's still in office. We need to get him out.
Want to be part of our show? Call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. And give us your thoughts on any of our stories. And you can even send us a voice recording or memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. A recent report from the nonprofit groups Communities for Sheriff Accountability and Common Cause investigated campaign finance data of sheriff campaigns across the country and found a pattern of conflicts of interest and ethical concerns. The report, called The Paid Jailer, reveals more than $6 million in potential conflicts of interest for sheriffs in 11 different states. These sheriffs, who are elected officials, received contributions from businesses that stood to benefit from contracts with the sheriff offices and jails under their control. Keisha Morris-Dazier is Census and Mass Incarceration Project Manager at Common Cause. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
Absolutely. So, all right, Keisha, let's just start by telling me a little bit about how this report came to be. So why the decision to take a look at elected sheriffs?
This report is really a culmination of about 1 year of research. We sent about 100 Freedom of Information requests to different county sheriffs. Of those 100 FOIA requests that we sent, about 48 sheriffs came back with contracts that they have with different industries. Of the 48 sheriffs, we digged into the campaign finance reports of those sheriffs. And what we found was really striking. We found that 40% of all the donations that we researched came from industries that serve to benefit by doing business with the sheriff's office. And, you know, we found that those business interests really can establish a relationship with the sheriff by making even really small contributions. For example, in Massachusetts, we saw that CPS Healthcare, documented as one of the worst prison and jail healthcare companies in the country, spent about $20,000 on sheriff campaigns in Massachusetts, with 12,000 of those donations going directly to Sheriff Hodson in Bristol County. And those low-level donations paid off about 500-fold for CPS Healthcare, because they were then awarded about $10 million in contracts from 2012 to 2021.
Okay, pause right there for a second, Keisha. How do we know that the contracts are a direct result? So I get it. There's like a follow the money and a bit of a presumption of that kind of influence. But do you know anything about the contracting process? Were they using, you know, redacted bids? Were they going, you know, did this company actually put in the lowest bid? I just, you know, I'm trying to figure out if these are the appearance of an ethical problem or an actual ethical problem.
So that's the thing. We really don't know. You know, we know that the appearance of a conflict of interest is sometimes just as damning as an actual conflict of interest. So what we say and how we define conflicts of interest is we say that this is the appearance of an ethically conflicted donation, because these industries are doing business with the sheriff's office, like construction industries, food services, weapons manufacturers, and those folks are donating and then receiving contracts, even if they're not doing a great job. That is the case across industries. In Florida, we saw that in Pinellas County, a transportation company called G4S, they donated about $6,000 in campaign contributions. They still had their contract renewed, even with multiple separate instances of people dying in their care.
So, Keisha, you're kind of curling my hair here with some of the stories that you have been telling us. So, again, help us understand sort of who county sheriffs are. What is under their control? If I live in a community with an elected sheriff, what kinds of aspects of our community are they managing?
Absolutely. So the sheriffs control a large portion of our lives. You know, they patrol our communities. Sheriff deputies arrest more than 2 million people a year. And they also, in certain places, work with ICE to put people in detention centers. And then they're also responsible for helping landlords evict their tenants. And as this report details, these sheriffs also oversee our jails, and that's probably one of their biggest responsibilities.
Are county sheriffs always elected? Are there any places where they get into office some other kind of way?
So in most of the communities that we have come across, sheriffs have been elected. There are more than 3,000 sheriffs across the country. And again, they have enormous unchecked power. Their roles differ by state, but, you know, they play, as I said, three major roles: to police, to make arrests, to supervise the jails. They oversee people in those jails, about 746,000 individuals at any given time.
So given how frequently our sheriffs and how important they are and how frequently it is that they are elected, you would think, right, sort of the theory of elections is that allows us to hold them particularly accountable, right? Because if they were appointed, they could be doing these kinds of things and we wouldn't know about it. What I'm wondering is whether or not, like, this visibility, you said that you tried to do the FOIA requests, you only got back about half of them, which is not so bad for FOIA, really. But I'm wondering if you've seen any sheriffs, for example, have a strong candidate running against them in the next election as a result of these kinds of, of ethical concerns.
Of these 100 sheriffs that we chose, most of them are coming up for election this year. So a part of our goal is to make sure that people get the data, they see who is donating to their sheriff, and see whether or not their sheriff has some ethically conflicted donations, and that they can make the decision for themselves whether or not the sheriff is someone that they want to be representing them. On our website, where you can find the report, thepaidjailer.org, we list all of the data that we got from campaign finance reports and also from contracts. And this is important because a lot of states don't make this information accessible. We believe that, you know, campaign finance reports should be available and accessible online, but many of the places that we researched did not have this information easily accessible. You know, we had to, as I said, do some FOIA requests, we had to send emails, and that really shouldn't be the case because these are our elected officials. We should know who is donating to them.
Keisha Morris-Desir is Census and Mass Incarceration Project Manager at Common Cause. Thank you for being here, Keisha.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Absolutely. We turn now to the state of Georgia, where a new guaranteed income program is scheduled for launch in the coming weeks. In her hands is a partnership between the Georgia Resilience and Opportunity, or GROW Fund, and GiveDirectly, who are planning to supply 650 Black women across Georgia with $850 a month over the course of 2 years. The project came to be after a task force of community members examined the root of economic insecurity and wealth disparities. In her hands will direct $13 million with hopes of addressing some of the highest income inequality in the nation. We're joined now by Hope Willensack, Executive Director of the Georgia Resilience and Opportunity Fund and co-director of the In Her Hands Initiative. Hope, it's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Clearly, you were not, you don't find yourself in this position because your first name is Hope, but it is a great first name for being in this position. And I'm wondering what you're hoping this initiative will in fact do in Georgia and for Black women specifically.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I'm hoping this will accomplish is sort of embedded also in the name of the program, In Her Hands. In the late 1960s, Dr. Martin Luther King said that the dignity of the individual will flourish when matters concerning his life are in his hands. And so he continues on to talk about a number of policies and programs around economic security, including a guaranteed income. So we named this program In Her Hands in honor of that. One, this means putting cash in the hands of women so that they have greater agency and choice, especially for Black women and women broadly who have experienced really some of the brunt causes of our economic insecurity in our economy. Two is that this program is designed by and for community members. So it is not just designed for them, but it's designed actually with community members. So sort of the design of this program is in our hands. And then finally, that policy should really be driven by those who are most impacted by the problem. And so we really want to think about those on who've been pushed to the margins, have the widest view of the world, and they really have the most to teach the world about the solutions to that those problems. And so they should really have the power in their hands to shape and drive those solutions. And so we view it as both a how we think about guaranteed income, let's say, but our goals are also that this sort of shifts the paradigm on how we approach society's deepest problems and who should be in positions of power around them.
Okay, so let's talk about first guaranteed income. I know we've been hearing about it more in recent years as both pilot programs in Stockton, California, an actual city-led program that emerged under the former mayor, Michael Tubbs. But help us to understand what guaranteed income is and how it's different from other kinds of cash transfer programs.
Yeah, a guaranteed income is typically an unconditional cash transfer program that provides, at least for a short period of time in these pilots, an income floor. So what we've heard from community members and what King realized over nearly 60 years ago is that it is very difficult to make choices about your life. It is very difficult to have midterm and long-term planning about your life when you're facing constant and prolonged scarcity. We're not talking about a couple missed paychecks. We're talking about years upon years, generations of sort of cash scarcity and financial scarcity. And so an income floor really provides that stability for people to make choices about their lives and their future that we anticipate will have ripple effects across for their children and across generations and certainly across communities. So when we say guaranteed income, it's usually a focused economic support or focused direct financial support to members of a community, let's say below an income threshold or within a geographic area. And so we really think of this as sort of, and it may be sort of different for different communities. It sort of has an equity lens to it that different groups and communities are facing different economic challenges that are systemic. And so maybe we have a guaranteed income that actually recognizes those different challenges that exist across groups.
And that's where I want to go next is I can imagine some folks are like, wait, what? Why is it going to just one category of persons, Black women? So if you could talk a bit about that and also maybe tell us how you define Black women.
Yeah. So the focus on Black women really had three rationale. One was that it came from the community task force. So when we looked at the root causes of economic insecurity in the old Fourth Ward neighborhood, that's where King was born, across Atlanta, across our state, across the country, what we really saw is that economic insecurity is pervasive. It is felt by many different groups across our country and takes hold and manifests in various different ways, sort of depending on what your identity might be and what your income is. Certainly not just people in poverty. Economic insecurity even extends well up into the middle class, the famous statistics that most Americans can't afford a $400 emergency. But what we saw in particular in this neighborhood and in Georgia, and that might resonate and likely resonates in many places across the country, is that Black women face particularly acute systemic challenges when it comes to achieving economic security. We know Black women make 63 cents on the dollar compared to the white male counterparts. In Georgia, they're twice as likely to live in poverty as white women. They're also one of the most likely groups to get stuck in poverty. And these are not because of individual bad choices. It is because there is a system that is set up that makes it really hard to do well and to thrive. And of course, Black women are resilient and resourceful, even at times when we shouldn't have to be as resilient as we are. And so really the focus on Black women was one, a recommendation from the community members, two, looking at the data. And then three, we know that when we invest in Black women, we're really creating an economy, a society where everyone can thrive by focusing on those who have been most marginalized, both historically and ongoing. So this is where the focus on Black women came from. And we hope that sort of these programs can continue to grow, continue to focus on more groups and continue to generate learnings that hopefully won't just be one program, but will reverberate into policy.
Say one more word on who Black women are. Does this include cis and trans women? Does it include Black women who are, maybe domestically born, but also perhaps those who are immigrants? I'm just kind of wondering how expansive the definition is.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking. Yep. It includes all women, cis and trans women, and then race is self-identified. So it includes all Black women. Yep.
All right, Hope, I want to think a bit about the connections between economic well-being and political capacity, in part because obviously all eyes have been on Georgia over the course of the past year, maybe 2 years, and largely kind of in a political realm, asking questions about voter turnout, about the high levels of voter registration. And I'm wondering whether or not you see connections between economic health and political health for a state like Georgia.
Absolutely. I think King even spoke about this in his final book, Chaos Our Community. He talked a lot about the connection between our democratic choices and financial freedom and sort of economic freedom, that our sort of democratic freedoms are quite shallow and maybe lack choice if we don't actually have financial and economic freedoms, as he was talking about a guaranteed income. And I think the same is true here today. When we are so focused on how we will pay the rent, put clothing on our children's back, again, not just for short periods of time, but for long extended periods of time in people's lives, it is very difficult to advocate for yourself, for your community, to think about really ambitious changes for your community. The community members that we spoke to, we talk to them not only about their challenges, but their ambitions for their community. But those can seem often very far off and very difficult to achieve, again, if we're worried about sort of our economic security in the short term. And so when we think about really what will sort of change things, both engage people in, we're excited to learn about what will engage people in their community when they have a guaranteed income. Is their civic engagement increased? You know, what changes can they advocate for in their community? But also this link between our civic freedoms and our financial freedoms and what that means for actually a thriving society where everyone has what they need.
Now, I know that part of the concern here was both the realities of income inequality, but also of wealth inequality. But the wealth inequality gap for between basically white Americans and both African Americans and Latino households is enormous. It's gaping. It grows, and it seems to grow, not just seems to, it empirically has grown over time, even as income inequality has narrowed, at least narrowed some. So I'm wondering, on the one hand, this seems extraordinarily impactful for each individual household, but can $850 a month truly make a difference when it comes to the problem of the wealth gap?
We view this program and any potential policies that might be similar to a guaranteed income as one piece of a multifaceted and multi-layered policy change and infrastructure change that really helps to close the racial wealth gap. Certainly, income stability and rising incomes can be a powerful tool in providing a buffer against wealth decelerators or the things that often take away wealth from Black households and households of color. But we're not quite sure how much it will do in terms of a wealth accelerator. So being able to access resources that would dramatically increase your household wealth. No single policy will be a panacea. And that when we actually think about this holistically across many different policy areas, across many domains, that's when we can probably get some traction on the racial wealth gap. And this is one crucial piece to that. But that it would be probably a suite of policies that would do that.
Now, how are households sort of identified for participation in the program?
Yeah, so our focus is on Black women within three geographies in Georgia. We're one of the first statewide programs. So we'll be starting in the Old Fourth Ward. We'll be doing lots of outreach to community members in the Old Fourth Ward and working with community-based organizations. We'll also be reaching out to women in Southwest Georgia. This is a rural area of Georgia. We're the only guaranteed income program to include or to focus on rural areas, which we think is really really important and really important learnings if we're thinking about how this might translate into policy. So we'll be working there, again, outreach, talking to folks, talking to those in churches. We have a focus on a couple counties down there and then in the Atlanta suburbs as well. So we'll be doing outreach in the communities that we're focused on. This community-based approach is really important to us. That way we can actually talk to people, explain the program, answer any concerns that they may have about the program or how it may, you know, impact their life and help and be a support in that way where needed. And so it'll be eligible women, low-income women in these three different geographies, and we'll be doing heavy outreach. But folks are also welcome to visit our website, thegrowfund.org. That's the GROfund.org as the website, as the application will be up on the website early this year.
Now that's the kind of output side. Talk to me about the input side. Where'd y'all get $13 million?
Yes. So we've been really grateful for a diverse group of donors who've really supported this work and believed in it. And so this is a philanthropically funded program. We would love to see sort of if the programs like these can get additional public funding. Obviously, there was the Child Tax Care Credit, which functioned a bit like a guaranteed income. Many states have an earned income tax credit. About 30 states have an earned income tax credit and the federal government does as well. Georgia is one of 20 states that does not. So we're philanthropically funded, but we would love to see, you know, if there could be additional public dollars towards supporting, towards direct financial assistance for those most in need in our community.
All right, last question here. As you're looking at Black women, is this also a program that is going to focus specifically on Black mothers? So I'm wondering here, as folks are identified, as you're thinking about this, I know government programs have frequently invested exclusively in people who are parenting solo, which is a space of critical need. But I wonder, or there have sometimes been critiques that those programs mean that people who are in committed relationships or who are married, who are also economically marginal, don't have access to these kinds of programs, or that women who are not themselves parents may not have access. So I'm wondering sort of how you were thinking about family structure as part of this as well.
Yeah, we wanted to be as inclusive as possible in terms of family structure. So folks who are partnered, unpartnered, have children, are not parents, all are welcome to participate in this program. And we think that it's important that many different groups are experiencing this pretty significant economic strain. And so we wanted to make sure that our program was inclusive, not only to help, provide a relatively short-term 2-year financial support for those enrolled in the program, but also so that these voices are a part of a critical policy discussion on what economic security looks like, not just for those with children and for those who are married, but for those who may be single without children. Also because we often view those as really stagnant aspects of people's life, but those change all the time. Although well-meaning, the programs that overly focus on someone's household status can exclude certain groups of people. And then those groups of people are often the last to receive support, if they receive any at all. And it's often very little.
Thank you. Hope Willensack is the executive director of the Georgia Resilience and Opportunity Fund and co-director of the In Her Hands Initiative. Hope, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for our show today. We hope we kept you listening. And we always appreciate when you spend part of your day with us here at The Takeaway. Call us about anything. Show ideas, suggestions, your own take on our stories. We want to hear from you. So call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or get on that Twitter machine and send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.